Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These, a show about difference and difficult conversations. On today's show, we're going to talk about one thing. We're going to talk about the death penalty. And I'll warn you, the second half of the show, I will have a conversation with my former colleague at MTV News, Jamil Smith. We will probably talk about the morality of the death penalty and the political divisions that it brings up and doesn't bring up. Those pro-life people who, for some reason, are also pro-death penalty, for instance. But the conversation that I think we can bring you that you might not get elsewhere is with Brian Lyman. He is a reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser, and he just covers the Department of Corrections. And part of his beat is the death penalty. He's actually witnessed an execution, and he's seen what happens before and after. I wanted to talk to him not about the morality of it, but about this, the process and the experience. What is it like in that room? What is the aftermath? What has covering the death penalty done to him? So, Brian Lyman, in a minute. You're a state government reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser in Montgomery, Alabama.
That's right.
And the reason why you're on, which is something that you tweeted a while ago that I saw, quote, "A few things in my experience are more depressing than covering an execution. Enormous waste and loss on all sides." So why don't you tell me first about the circumstances of what brought you to tweet that? And then, like, I want to dig in on exactly what your experience has been.
When you cover a death penalty, any kind of death penalty case, you're confronted with a lot of horror. You start with the crime, for example. One of the death penalty cases that I've covered involved a man who was convicted of shooting a police officer and shooting his girlfriend while his girlfriend was trying to protect her child from the gunshots. There's just horrible stories of assault, murder, just dead. And you see these things detailed in the court filing. So you read about that stuff. That's horrible to read. And, you can only imagine what it's like for the victims and the family members who were involved with that. Then you look at how the legal system worked. And oftentimes you're looking at a number of failures or a number of questionable decisions. Alabama until this year had a provision where a judge could basically overturn the decision of a jury to give a life sentence. Like, a judge could basically take that jury's recommendation and decide to impose a death sentence in its place. And there were judges in Alabama who were notable for doing this, particularly in the mid-90s.
Yeah, can I jump in with a question on that? Do you elect your judges?
Yes, all the judges are elected. And that was in fact, that brought down some criticism from Sonia Sotomayor about 4 years ago, that, this was giving judges a lot of pressure to impose a death penalty when they, even if they felt that it wasn't warranted in those cases. You know, I spoke with a circuit judge. The case that Sonia Sotomayor actually took place in Montgomery, and I spoke with the judge back in 2013 about the circumstances around it. And he told me, you know, I agree with her. I don't want this power at all, but I was bound by the law to impose the death sentence in this case. The case involved a man who had killed a Montgomery police officer. Mm-hmm. The legislature this year only got rid of it, and it was only after a few years of people like trying to get rid of judicial override in the state of Alabama.
So you're taking me through the sort of the enormous waste and loss on both sides. Mm-hmm. There's the crime itself, you said, which is, of course, and when the death penalty is brought up, you're almost guaranteed it's going to be horrific crime that people are talking about. But then the system starts and you have this first layer, which is that a jury can decide that for whatever reason, they don't think the death penalty is warranted. You know, perhaps they've been given evidence for whatever mitigating circumstances, whatever we don't know. Right. But the jury decides it's not warranted. But then, because judges are perhaps thinking about the public pressures, for instance, they can override that.
Right until this year.
This year, they can override that. So that's like one of the first institutional or systemic things that happens that feels, you know, not like justice, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What happens next? Like, what are, take us through like all the things that you're thinking about when you think of it as this enormous waste of law and loss.
Well, and continuing on the legal process, for example, you have something that you have several different layers of appeals. There's a direct appeals process that's based on the merits of the case. But then you have something called a Rule 32 procedure, which essentially is a place where you can challenge the adequacy of your counsel or bring up any other issues that may have come up in the trial. Robert Nelson, whose execution I covered in June, his attorneys who were supposed to be handling his Rule 32 petition lived outside of Alabama, and they missed some critical filing deadlines in his Rule 32 process. So he found out about this months later, and you know, the attorneys, I don't think there was any bad faith on the attorney's part. They just didn't understand how the state system worked. So, I mean, you're talking about also, you know, like Nelson's, I think the facts of the case strongly point that Nelson was guilty of the crime he was committed, the crime he was convicted of, which was another ghastly crime. But you see that he had the same right to make these arguments in the appeals process, that, you know, because he was given unskilled lawyers or unfamiliar lawyers, he didn't get those. So that was, you know, there's another breakdown of the system there, where, you know, the legal representation that should be there, you know, to ensure that if this machinery is going forward, you know, oftentimes it's not there. And it's, you know, and so that's certainly one other thing you think about. And I guess, I mean, you know, the other thing too, to think about too, is just these are long drawn out procedures. And you just think about just all the lost time, you know, not for the victims, for the families, you know, maybe even sometimes for the families of those who are convicted of it. The tweet I sent out regarded the Thomas Arthur case. The crime that Thomas Arthur committed took place, the crime that Thomas Arthur was convicted of took place on February 1st, 1982. On February 1st, 1982, I was 4 years old. Mm. I've lived an entire life since then. I've graduated from college, I've married, I've had children, you know, I've pursued a career. You know, the victim didn't get to live those years. The family of the victim didn't get to live those years. You know, even, you know, you know, if Thomas Arthur spent 35 years in a small cell block. If, you know, you think about the waste of a life that is, you know, if you made different choices. I mean, those are the kinds of things. I mean, those are the kinds of things that you think about. Arthur, in his case, like, he was convicted of that crime when he was serving a life sentence for a previous murder too. So, and he was in a work release program. I mean, like, you just can't get away from just the, when you're dealing with these death penalty cases, you're often seeing just the absolute worst of what can happen in somebody's life and what can happen in society.
And there's yet another layer that happens too in Alabama specifically, and other states are seeing this as well, which is what goes on at the execution, where Alabama has had questions raised about the efficacy of the drugs that they use and the stability of the drugs that they use.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Alabama, like many other states, uses a three-drug protocol, and the sedative, the idea of the process is that you get three drugs. The first one is supposed to be a sedative that knocks you out. The second one is supposed to be a paralytic that, you know, freezes your muscles. And the third is supposed to stop your heart. Ideally, if this works out well, you know, you hope that the goal is that the prisoner is unconscious when the fatal drugs are administered to them. For years, Alabama and a lot of other states used this drug called sodium thiopental, but pressure on the drug maker basically took that drug away from the market back in 2011. At the time, Alabama switched to pentobarbital, and it conducted at least one execution with pentobarbital. That drug was taken off the market, and Alabama did not have an execution for about 2.5 years after that. And then Alabama adopted Florida's execution protocol, which uses a drug called midazolam. Midazolam is supposed to be a sedative, but it's not intended to bring people to a state of deep unconsciousness. So, and I've talked to medical professionals who've said, you know, midazolam is the kind of drug where, you know, if you're faced with a high stress event, like an execution,
like being murdered, killed. It's like, I'll stay away from the value judgment. But if you're, for instance, about to be killed, that might be a high stress.
The drug's efficacy could be wiped out. And that's a question that's come up with other, it's a question that's come up in executions. Since executions resumed in Alabama at the start of 2016, speaking with my colleagues who have witnessed, you know, more executions than I have, most of them have gone off without problems. There was, however, one in December, the execution of Ronald Burt Smith, who was seen to be gasping and just coughing repeatedly. I think he was gasping and coughing for 13 of the 34 minutes when he was executed. And there've been, you know, there was a case in Arizona where the inmate apparently gasped over 600 times while his execution was being was taking place. The Alabama Department of Corrections, and I should say, like, when I've been at these executions, the staff has been, you know, nothing but somber and, you know, as professional as you can be in those situations. But they've never, like the Ronald Burt Smith case, for instance, you know, like, it's not clear what exactly happened there. But we do know that when executions have gone wrong in recent years, midazolam has often been present. Now, whether it's the chief cause or whether there are issues with, you know, IV lines or whatnot, you know, that's something that's come up. But, you know, one of the common threads for all this stuff is that midazolam is present in these executions.
Framebridge is the easiest way to custom frame your favorite art and photos without ever leaving your house. With their simple online ordering process, you can order a fully customized piece in minutes. And here is how it works. You go to framebridge.com. You upload your photo from your computer or directly from Instagram. Or if you have a physical item, they will provide a secure prepaid package so you can mail it in for free. Preview your photo online in any frame style. Choose your favorite or get free help from their talented designers. And the expert team at Framebridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. And the best part, instead of the hundreds of dollars you'd pay at a framing store, their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free. Plus, my listeners get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com when they use the code FRIENDS. Framebridge even offers a happiness guarantee, which I assume has to do with the frame itself and not your life in general. But if for any reason you aren't 100% satisfied with your order, they will make it right. Now, I have used Framebridge myself primarily for Instagram photos. I have a ton of pictures from the campaign, all on Instagram. They're a document of living history. And I've used Framebridge to do kind of a little triptych of some of the conventions, which are a year ago now. I can't quite believe that. They have tons of different frames to offer, a lot of different styles. I've gone with something very sleek and modern, although I have also toyed with doing something from the Trump rallies in a really rococo, like super ostentatious, very Trumpy kind of style, like a big gold gilt frame. I will let you know if I do that. But I can attest the process is really easy. It's as easy as using Instagram itself. And if you are a With Friends Like These listener, you can use the code FRIENDS to get, as I said, an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com, promo code FRIENDS. Again, that's framebridge.com, promo code FRIENDS. While we're talking about being present at executions, this brings us to your personal experience. You were actually at an execution in June.
Yes, the execution of Robert Nelson.
Yes. So I guess, you know, what was that like?
The best way I can describe it is that it's kind of like walking into a tomb. You walk into a short hallway. There are white bricks all around you. And you go into a room. It's slightly dark. There's a window. There's a window on one side that has a curtain. There with a red light shining from above within the room. So you have this kind of like ghostly red light that's in a room that's no bigger than a small bedroom. There are signs just reminding people to be quiet, you know, during the whole process. I can tell you, like, when I was there, nobody had difficulties being quiet. And, you know, at some point the curtain is pulled and you see, you see the person, the condemned inmate, it's basically a hospital gurney, probably the best way to describe it. The warden has a microphone and, you know, basically reads out the sentence. The inmate is given a chance to say any last words, and chaplain, you know, the chaplain, you know, like maybe will kneel and say a prayer with the inmate, and then the process begins.
Mm-hmm. I know you said you've applied or tried to be present for others, mm-hmm. other executions. This is the first one you're actually at.
Right.
Now, as a fellow journalist, I'm curious, though, why did you feel like it was important to be there? What's the value of being there?
I cover state government. That's my day job. And there's probably no greater power that the Alabama state government has than to, you know, carry out or conduct an execution. Some people may have strong objections to that power. Some people may say that's a duty that the state government has. But as a reporter, I think it's important that we witness all exercises of what the government does. And, you know, as difficult as it may be to watch, I think we have to be there to, you know, bear witness to what's being done.
And was it difficult to watch for you?
I was intensely nervous, and you know, I'm on the ride home, for instance, you know, the execution chamber is a long way away. It's in the middle of a rural area, so you have a very long drive back after these things happen. So you know, it's certainly a difficult thing to watch, and I, you know, made a point to call my wife, you know, and just kind of talk things through, you know, after everything that happened. And but yeah, I mean, you know, it's certainly something it's not something I would look forward to. And I think, you know, I don't think any of my colleagues would look forward to covering this, but at the same time, I think we have a duty to do so.
You know, we've talked about what you've described, you know, as the waste and loss of an execution, and we haven't even actually yet touched on what most people might think of as the you know, biggest consideration when talking about the death penalty, which is whether or not innocent people wind up, you know, going that far. And Alabama, unfortunately, has some experience on that side of it too, right? There's pretty recently, in 2015, a man was let off of death row after being proven innocent.
That's right. Yeah. That was Anthony Ray Hinton. Yeah. Yeah. And I can say for, you know, when you get into those questions are hard for, you know, like if you're covering an let me say this, the capital cases that I've covered to this point, the evidence that I've seen in court, or the evidence I've seen in court records, would tend to point to the people who are being executed to having done it. Like it's hard to say that. I don't know that I have real, there are some, you know, there's some questions about, like, you know, certain things, but in my experience, it's not so much a question of guilt as so much as, you know, like, well, did these people get adequate representation, or did they get, you know, like a fair shake, you know, like in the appeals process, or, you know, like, were they served well by the court system? Were there political considerations that, you know, like maybe put them on death row that might have put somebody else in a prison in a prison cell for the rest of their lives? Now, that's not to say that, you know, there may not be, that there could be innocent people on death row. They're very well, there are other cases that are coming up that, you know, I think there are, some of those inmates may have a stronger case, you know, for their innocence of these crimes. But in general, like when I've seen the problems with it, it's generally with the appeals process and the existing process there.
Well, that's interesting on itself, though, that an objection, because I think a lot of people would be like, well, of course the death penalty is wrong and wasteful if you're putting an innocent man through this. But your mm-hmm. point is that it can be wasteful, and you're not making a judgment on the wrongness of it, but you're seeing the waste and loss as a journalist, even with people who you feel pretty certain, you know, were correctly found guilty. But whether the question for you and you seem to be maybe posing for the rest of us to consider is the death penalty the right outcome here?
Right.
And then, for instance, in the situation you described earlier with the out-of-state counsel, my gathering is the real irony there is the out-of-state counsel missed the deadline to file in an area of appeals that had to do with being adequately represented.
Right.
I mean, that's, yeah. You know.
Yeah. It's something I often notice when I'm, like if I'm covering an execution, there's, you know, and I'm not doubting their motives or anything, but there's, you know, a lot of folks, you know, who are trying to you know, like called, so like say that an execution shouldn't happen because the person is innocent. And to, like I said, with the capital cases I've covered, the facts have tended to point to, not in all cases, but the facts have tended to point toward a person's guilt. But there's a stronger case to be made about, you know, like, did the process serve them correctly? I mean, I've said this on Twitter, and I've said this in the past that, you know, you can believe that this person is guilty and still, I mean, whatever your feelings are, I mean, you can believe that person is guilty and you can still oppose their execution. I mean, you know, one does not necessarily cancel out the other.
And that maybe brings us to some more recent happenings in the Alabama, you know, criminal justice system, which is they want to make it easier to get to the death part in the death penalty, right?
Mm-hmm. The legislature passed the law, which some other states have it as well. But right now, when you exhaust, and this only covers state appeals, but right now the way it works is like when you exhaust your direct appeals, your Rule 32 appeals process begins, where you can challenge things like the adequacy of counsel. The law that was passed by the legislature this spring has both processes run concurrently, and that's become a major issue for defense attorneys, because, you know, like they bring out the point, like, how can you challenge the adequacy of your counsel when your counsel is handling your direct appeal? I mean, you're basically trying to undermine your counsel's competence, your counsel's competence, at the same time that your counsel is basically trying to defend you through this appeals process.
So that's sort of pointing to the fact of, like, whether or not you think this person is innocent, whether or not you think the death penalty itself is wrong, there may be something, sort of the deck is stacked in the appeals process. I also wanted to ask you sort of some Alabama specific questions here. Mm-hmm. Are the chief law enforcement officer in the land, Jeff mm-hmm. Sessions, is of course former Alabama senator. Someone covering the criminal justice system in Alabama. Do you think that there's anything that America can learn from what's going on in Alabama about what might be in our future?
Sessions was Attorney General of Alabama back in the mid 90s, but he's pretty much been a senator. He was sworn in 1997, so he hasn't had a direct hand in the Alabama criminal system. Now criminal justice system. Now, that said, there are definitely things to learn from Alabama. One of which is that we have, one of the chief problems we have is our prisons are terribly overcrowded. I think the last figure I saw was that the prisons are at 172% capacity.
Wait, say that again? 172?
Yeah, 172% capacity. Mm-hmm. The current system we have, and I can recite this number because I've written about it repeatedly over the last 5 years, but the current prison system we have was built to house 13,318 inmates. It currently holds about 23,000 inmates. And that is actually progress, believe it or not, because back in 2007, it was closer to 25,000 inmates. It was almost 200% capacity. Why did that happen? You know, Alabama was an early adopter of habitual offender laws. There were mandatory sentencing laws, and you had a legislature that, you know, couldn't wait to declare, you know, as many felonies as it could. Now, to its credit, the legislature has recognized this and is trying to turn things around. They passed a comprehensive sentencing reform package a few years back. They also passed a prison reform package to try and, like, one of the things that we had was, you know, like, a lot of people were in prison for technical parole violations, and we passed a sweeping prison reform bill modeled on Texas's, and that's reduced the entire prison population by about 2,000 inmates over the last few years. So the overall population is coming down, but, you know, the, the conditions in Alabama prisons are still terrible. The prisons have suffered for years from, you know, like basically stagnant funding. And, these were not necessarily Alabama exclusive problems. But these are the kinds of decisions that have been made by Alabama politicians for bad. And then I guess, you know, for recently for good, at least, you know, they're recognizing the problem and trying to address the situation.
But to be clear, actually, Jeff Sessions was involved in the creating the problem part. He hasn't been involved in state government for the fixing the problem part.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he was, I mean, you know, it's a lot of the decisions that screwed up our prison system predate Jeff Sessions. I mean, I don't know that he was, he wouldn't have been elected attorney general if he wasn't a tough on crime kind of guy. But again, that's not necessarily like Sessions himself. That's the whole state or the whole, I mean, you know, I don't know that in the mid 90s you would have been able to elect any attorney general in any part of the country who wasn't a tough on crime.
Right. Well, fair point. But actually, I guess I can say this, maybe you can't, but Jeff Sessions still seems stuck in that era. My concern is that Jeff Sessions hasn't changed very much, even though some conservatives, in fact, have. Some conservative lawmakers in Alabama have moved on that issue.
It has been noted that Alabama is trying to make it, like, just trying to reduce its prison population, whereas Jeff Sessions is taking measures that would likely increase prison population overall. Yeah, that would be a fair statement.
Not that that's funny, but it's hard. It's terrible. Just, we live in an age of irony upon irony and injustice upon injustice. And sometimes that makes me, I have no other response but to chuckle. Yes, you too. Before you go, I actually wonder also, you were covering, you said you just had been on the phone with Mo Brooks. What is going on in Alabama politics right now?
Let's see. Do you have another hour to talk about that?
Well, I'm especially curious about what we can learn. You know, like, I mean, I do feel like there's some use to look to Alabama for what the rest of the country might be able to understand, because Alabama is a place that I think the current administration is getting some people and ideas from. So, wonder if you can help us out with that.
Let's see. I mean, I can tell. Obviously, we have a Senate election, which is, we have the incumbent Luther Strange, a former Alabama Attorney General, running against Roy Moore, who your listeners probably best know as the Ten Commandments judge. And you have Mo Brooks, the congressman, and he was part of the Tea Party vanguard here. The campaign is kind of taking this interesting twist because, Luther Strange is basically getting all the money, and he's getting money from Mitch McConnell. Mo Brooks has kind of won the radio endorsement primary. Like, he's been backed by Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham, and I think probably more critically, a lot of the local conservative radio, especially in Birmingham and North Alabama, are fully on his side. And then you have Roy Moore, who has pretty much all the faith voters and also has the most motivated faith voters. So if you were to create an experiment where you split three key elements of the Republican coalition in Alabama and then have them fight each other, you would have the Alabama Senate race pretty much. You've got the money versus the radio versus the faith-based voters. It's become an unusual dynamic, up until, I want to say, about 2 weeks ago, I mean, the Republican campaign was basically like, you know, who loves Donald Trump the most? But then Donald Trump attacked Jeff Sessions, who's still popular with primary voters here. And that kind of threw everybody for a loop, or threw the campaigns for a loop, because, they didn't want to choose sides between these two. You know, I mean, it was almost like mom and dad are fighting, you know, like at this point. They're talking about basic things like you'll see a lot of, oftentimes, like, they're doing things that seem disconnected from, you know, like what's actually happening in Alabama. Like, for instance, they all came out for repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Well, nearly all the repeal bills included cuts to Medicaid, which a million Alabamians, most of them children, depend on for health insurance. It also keeps the hospitals open. It keeps the primary care providers open. So, you know, I would ask him, so, you know, what do you think about these cuts to Medicaid? And they really didn't have an answer. Like, they, most of them didn't really have an answer, like, beyond going beyond the slogan. You had, there is that. There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of tough talk about immigration, getting tough on immigration. Only 3.5% of Alabama's population is foreign-born, compared with, I think it's like 13% maybe nationwide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, I can tell you, I mean, if there's any lessons, I'll say this. The Alabama Senate race is becoming this curious disconnect between, you know, what the campaigns say is important and what's actually happening on the ground in Alabama. And in some cases, it's leading them into places where they could, or it's leading them into votes that could be seriously harmful for people who actually live in the state.
I was going to say, I mean, do people in the state of Alabama have the different priorities? Because I do, it turns out a lot of people do know that when their care comes from Medicaid, for instance, they know that that's where they're getting their health care. So is that something that the voters might be aware they're being harmed?
It comes up I can say, like, it's the biggest single thing that the legislature deals with every year, because, I mean, it is the cornerstone of healthcare in Alabama. Whether people make the connection between, you know, Medicaid, like, I mean, because Medicaid is, it's thought of as this, you know, like, it's thought of as like a poverty program.
Yeah, people think of it as a poverty program, but it's not. I mean, foster children, disabled children in schools, hospitals. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a lot about Medicaid on the show. So our listeners are very aware that it's not for poor and disabled people necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, I can say we've, you know, like, not reporting, like, we've tried to explain what Medicaid does, and, you know, whether people necessarily make the connections, but if they're not making the connections from our reporting, you know, you have the Alabama Hospital Association, which is, you know, banging the drum and reminding people, hey, this is important. You have the local chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is, you know, like, saying, hey, we need this or else we're going to start pediatricians' offices are either going to lay people off or, especially in rural areas, shut down completely. So, I mean, those messages are getting out, whether they're actually landing with voters. I mean, you know, like, well, you know, it's hard to say, but I will say that on the state level, very few politicians ever wanted, like, be seen cutting Medicaid or doing anything like that. So, I mean, in that case, you know, like, within, you know, like, you know, down the street at the Alabama State Capitol, they're not going to be cutting Medicaid unless their hand is forced by something else, but they're not going to voluntarily do it.
Well, I would encourage people to pay attention, because I do think that there's a little microcosm of issues happening in the Alabama Senate race that definitely is happening on the national level. We didn't even get into the immigration front, although I will just point out that Alabama is representative in some ways of part of that debate, because Trump's strongest supporters, most anti-immigrant supporters, I believe there are demographic and electoral analysis that show they tend to be the ones with the least contact with foreign-born citizens. You can almost relate it on a, you know, one-to-one ratio. Like, if you have contact with immigrants, you tend to be more pro-immigration reform. If you don't have contact with immigrants, boy, are you angry. So
it's interesting. We do have a growing, immigrant community in Alabama. It's just small relative to, like, the population as a whole. I mean, it's growing, like, especially in North Alabama. Like, I think at one point, I remember 10 years ago, there were 27 different Mayan languages that were spoken in the state of Alabama because of, you know, we have Guatemalan immigrants, you know, mm-hmm. coming here. So, it's very interesting, like, just how, but it's still relatively small. It's small compared to the rest of the population. So, yeah, it's, we'll have to see how, I mean, like, if immigration trends continue, like, how these how these politics play out over the next few years.
If we're all still here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Yeah.
I really appreciate it. We'll stay in touch. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
So I actually think about Harry's razors almost every day because my husband not only uses Harry's razors, he actually has like a little stand that you can get from there that he bought extra. Doesn't come with the kit that he got to try. He bought it at a store. It's a little like zinc cube that you stand your razor up in. My husband is a very neat and tidy person. He's very selective about what we display on our bathroom counters. Sometimes he gets after me for what I put on it. So he really loves the look of this razor. I can say that it is pretty nifty. That is not why you would buy it unless you're, you know, not the person using it. He also loves what it does. I can attest that he looks great and feels great. And, you know, Harry's is also super convenient. And as the person, me, who does the shopping for the house, it's nice not to have that on my list. He is a subscriber to Harry's razors, which you can be too. They are all about a great shave at a fair price. And that is why over 3 million guys, including my husband, have switched to Harry's. Jeff and Andy are just two ordinary Joes who are fed up with buying overpriced razors. And so they started Harry's to fix shaving. They brought their own German factory with over 100 years of blade making experience to ensure the highest quality. All their products are backed by a 100% guarantee. And Harry's offers all their blades at half the price of the leading five-blade razor. And they sell directly to you over the internet. Like I said, you can actually subscribe so you don't have to remember to get razors. You are never out of razors. Claim your free trial offer from Harry's today. $13 value for free when you sign up. Just cover shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. It does not include the really cool zinc cube to display your razor on. You have to get that extra, but it is pretty cool. To get your free trial, go to harrys.com/friends right now. That's harrys.com/friends. So welcome back to the show, Jamil Smith, my former colleague, still friend, independent journalist and contributing writer to the Daily Beast. Welcome to the show, Jamil.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So I thought of you for this segment because I've just followed your writing, recent writing on the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And I know also in general, you and I share some points of view on criminal justice reform. I've missed you. I also wanted to have you on because we haven't talked in a while. But it also turns out that there's a personal experience you bring to bear on the subject that I confess I didn't know about. Why don't you tell us more about this?
So, again, thanks again for bringing me back on. It's really good to hear your voice, my friend. I wanted to, essentially, where do I start? I was 15 years old when my cousin Andre disappeared, and he, you know, it was about October. Nobody really knew where he was. We were panicked. We were freaked out. We didn't know what had happened to him. And, you know, months later, about 2 or 3 months later, he was found stabbed to death in the trunk of a car in Michigan. And we're from Cleveland. So, you know, there's a lot of, how do you end up in, you know, parking lot at the Pontiac Silverdome? There were a lot of questions involved and a lot of grief. It was the first time I'd ever had anybody close to me die. And Andre was, you know, 10 years older than me. He was like my big brother and the big brother I never had. And so this, it still to this day, you know, it still affects me greatly. It was, gosh, how many years ago? Oh my God. 25, 26 years ago. And we, they found the people who killed him. And we went to the sentencing, and my dad, my uncle, and me. And I sat there looking at the actual people who took Andre's life. And I watched the sentencing go down, and they got life without parole, and everything was fine. I just remember being so satisfied in that moment. Not that they got life without parole. I mean, we can get into the mass incarceration bit and whether or not that's enough to replace my cousin's life and whatnot. But just that, you know, they weren't going to be killed for this. I had every motivation in the world to want to see those people dead, you know, killed by the state as recompense for my cousin's life. And I just realized at that moment, and I remember very clearly sitting in that courtroom, I remember thinking, you know, I don't know if the state has the death penalty, but I really hope they don't get it. I really hope they have to think about it. I really hope that, you know, we're not the business of eye for an eye. And that really has informed my position on the death penalty ever since. I think it should be abolished. I think it's a, you know, racially imbalanced, you know, geographically imbalanced method of punishment that is primitive, medieval, and shouldn't be part of any kind of thing that we call America.
I'm especially interested in your experience because I do feel like one part of the debate over death penalty, kind of one that the surefire winner, if you're in a debate, is like some people are innocent and they shouldn't have to die. But that is not that's not necessarily the best argument against it, really. I mean, I think it's a great argument, right? Like one mm-hmm. innocent person is too many, but that's hopefully not, that's pretty rare. The stronger mm-hmm. argument, I think, and I think this is what you're sharing, is that even if someone is guilty, even if the system yeah. has found that person to have done the crime that they're accused of, the death penalty is not the most just way to end the process.
Right. I mean, for one, it's not a deterrent. We've seen that. You know, it's not as if death penalty states suddenly, you know, all of a sudden after the institution of the penalty, have lower murder rates, have lower rates of sexual assault. These are not deterrence. It's simply a matter of revenge. It's a matter of vengeance. It's not really anything to do with justice. And so that's the big sort of moral problem that I have with it. But you throw the racism into it, you know,
as one does, as it happens, yes. And it is inescapable too, because what happens, the real story of the death penalty is that it's unequally applied. That if you yeah. are a wealthy person, a privileged person, a white person, even if you committed the same sort of crime, you're not going to find yourself in the same position. And that's right. what's unjust about it.
Especially if you're, say, a black person killing a white person. Mm-hmm. Now, in my cousin's case, it was black people killing black people. Mm-hmm. So the Marshall Project, I remember, reported last year that 327 Americans at that point had been executed for interracial murders. Okay, so black defendants killing white victims, white defendants killing black victims, so on and so forth. Now, 296 of those were black defendants killing white people, and 31% were for whites who killed blacks. Now, that's the death penalty, okay? So killing white people killing black people is significantly less risk of getting the death penalty than black people killing white people. Not to say that, like, one is worse than the other, but why is the sentencing so disparate? And that, when you have something like that in your criminal justice system, you just can't abide by it. It's just inherently unfair. We really shouldn't have anything unfair in our justice system.
It is called justice. That's like the whole point.
I mean, you would think, you know, these days it's a little tough, you know, with the Department of Justice, you don't really know what's going on. But the point is, inherently, I think the death penalty not only is unjust and it's racist, but it's ineffective. Mm. It doesn't work. It doesn't stop people from committing crimes. It doesn't stop people from doing the kinds of things that earn a sentence of capital punishment. It just is for making people feel better, which frankly doesn't go a whole long way towards actual justice.
And it gives us an unfortunately really easy segue into talking about current events, which I don't think the death penalty is far away from current events. For one thing, it's very current in some places, like the reporter from Alabama we just talked to. But also, right. I've been thinking about the death penalty as part of our national conversation because, as recently as a year ago, there was a sense for those of us who watch and care about criminal justice reform that we were reaching a tipping point. you know,
mm-hmm.
that there was like a starting to be a consensus on both sides of the aisle towards reducing our prison population, towards getting rid of mandatory minimums, towards even towards not necessarily abolition of the death penalty, but there started to be a sense of maybe we need to reexamine this. Some states put them on hold, largely because they're having trouble getting execution drugs, but still that's a good reason to put them on hold. And also the national opinion polls were starting to trend mm-hmm. in the direction of being against the death penalty.
Right.
Okay, but that was a year ago.
People have different feelings now.
A year ago, you and I were at the Democratic Convention, and we were thinking, finally, you know what? Things are looking up.
I mean, it is kind of amazing to think about it, the fact that that was a year ago. We were sweating our brains out in Philly.
Yep.
And yet, thinking that, like, okay, this is so much better organized.
It was so much better.
So much better organized than the Republican Convention. The Republicans didn't seem to even know what they were doing. The programs were all messed up. The speeches were completely wing-nuttery. And it's
yep.
just...
And violent. The speeches were race baiting and violent, and anti-American in some senses. And the Democratic Convention was so patriotic, so uplifting. You know,
And speaking to the criminal justice element,
yeah.
the speeches were punctuated at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland by "Lock her up,
mm-hmm.
lock her up, lock her up." And so
yes.
there was, I guess, an element of criminal justice all throughout.
Yes. And so, yes, let's think about what's changed. We don't have to catalog everything. But so one of the things that's definitely changed is the direction of criminal justice reform, which is to say it's now directed backwards. and I worry that that bloodlust is going to recharge the batteries of those who think that we should be killing more people more often.
Yeah. I think that this Justice Department is doing some damage, I think, to America's moral fiber, not to speak too seriously.
I think that that's correct. Our president often gets the spotlight for that, but going mm-hmm. on behind the scenes everyday way. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason Jeff Sessions has not resigned despite being utterly humiliated. Anybody who's humiliated by their boss and the method that Jeff Sessions is undergoing right now probably resigned just out of spite, you know, let alone just out of pride. But he's doing his life's work right mm-hmm. now.
He loves it. And he's getting done
of doing.
And this is stuff that he's wanted to do long before Donald Trump got on the scene, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so what we're seeing, I think, is, you know, maybe not necessarily direct calls for increased capital punishment by Jeff Sessions, but we're seeing, you know, sort of an erosion of humanity in terms of, you know, suspects, in terms of people who use marijuana, for instance, mm-hmm. People who, you know, are not white, male, straight, what have you. Those people are pushed a little bit further into the category of automatic suspects mm-hmm. in the Jeff Sessions justice universe. That's a problem. It's something Black people have been working for generations to get out of, not just, you know, working through Jim Crow and trying to make sure that, you know, people get equal justice under the law, but also, frankly, recently, you know, we're dealing with the problem of mass incarceration. It's not just a problem about, you know, Black and it's not just a problem for Black people. No, it is predominantly one for people of color. It is a problem for all of us that people need to take seriously, because this country is becoming increasingly, you know, comfortable with solving its problems, its legal problems, its crime problems with just locking people away. And that doesn't really do anything. I mean, now it's better than killing them. that's certainly you can't reverse those kinds of mistakes, but that just the idea that this country is centered around locking people up until the face of the drug problem becomes white and then all of a sudden we're interested in treatment, that is it's a serious problem. And under Jeff Sessions, I only see that getting worse, especially for people, say, who use marijuana. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I'm not really sure what it will take for, you know, Trump to actually just fire Jeff Sessions. But I know there are a lot of people in the criminal reform community that would welcome that firing, despite the other consequences that may follow it.
Oh, I think that we're going to at least get at least one cycle of news that says he fires him over criminal justice reform issues, like the same way that they fired Comey because of, you know, he was unfair to Hillary. We're going to get at least one tweet or one message from the White House saying that, oh, well, Jeff Sessions, you know, is really terrible on civil liberties and that's why we fired him, which won't be the truth, but it'll be, you know, one tweet worth of news. From Malcolm Gladwell and Panoply Media, check out the new season of Revisionist History, a podcast that looks at events from the past and asks whether we got it right the first time. This season will explore a murder trial from the Jim Crow South and, I think, of special interest to With Friends Like These listeners, a story of a terrorist who had a change of heart. There'll be talk of French fries and the saddest song in the world, making mischief, putting crazy theories to the test. I could go on. It is going to be a wild ride. Listen in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I was going to point out that this dehumanizing of people on the wrong end of the criminal justice system, we may not be tying that directly to increased calls for capital punishment in the system, but we're getting dog whistle calls for increased application of capital punishment in the extrajudicial sense, with violence against people who are accused of crimes. That I know some people thought that that speech that Trump gave in front of the police in Long Island was kind of a sideshow, and you know, one of the 18 level dimensional, five dimensional chess games that they're playing to get us to not talk about Russia. But that was horrifying, and also, less attention was paid. I saw some people, you know, sort of in our circle of conversation, you know, progressive lefty people talk about the speech he gave in Ohio, where he talked, he gave a graphic description of a gang member. I think he used the terms slicing and dicing and young, beautiful girl.
And we know what kind of women Donald Trump finds beautiful.
Well, they are young. They're young for sure.
So,
and they're, yeah, they're white.
Talking about young white girls.
Young white girls. And I don't know if people realize, like, this is not, it's not a distraction when you're calling for violence, you know?
No. And it's also not a joke. This idea that the White House is dismissing his open endorsement, not just, you know, mention or recommendation, it was damn near an order to be rougher. He described literally the process by which Freddie Gray was killed in Baltimore. The rough ride. He actually uses the word rough in context with throwing people in the back of a van. And he just says, you know what? You're being too nice.
Yeah. You're being politically too nice correct.
When you let a 25-year-old kid get his neck broken in the back of a van. That's too nice.
And I guess the term politically correct can be used if you mean constitutional. I'm following the Constitution in this. That is like literally politically correct.
Kazir Khan, you know, I know offered him his copy of the Constitution and the president really should have taken him up on the offer.
Yeah.
Because it's clear that he has no either knowledge of or respect for the rights of due process. He certainly doesn't have any respect for them when it comes to himself. Why would he respect it when it comes to me and you?
Right. And I can actually tie this back to Russia in a way, which is that...
Oh, totally. It's totally connected. His police violence speech in Long Island and the speech about the MS-13 gang members, the Salvadoran gang in, you know, in Ohio, which really there's MS-13 gang members in Ohio. I'm from Ohio. I doubt really that that's the case. We're talking about these kinds of that kind of like over racist rhetoric. It's not just about the racism. It's about him covering his own butt. It's all about him showing an utter lack of respect for the rule of law and for and it's basically, you know, it's advocacy for, you know, people to be essentially vigilantes.
Right.
It's like it's people saying, hey, look, the police are being too nice, and you have these mortal, terrible terrorist threats, essentially, in your neighborhood. What are you going to do?
Right. It's an unjustified means mentality. And it's actually the through line here goes back to the way he won his election, right? Mm-hmm. It's disregard for rule of law, ends justify the means. We'll do anything we can to win, to beat the criminal, in which case in the election metaphor or parallel is Hillary. And then also the kinds of justice, so-called justice that he's arguing for, the kind of nationalism he advocates, is very much reflective of the kind of government that Putin has. So there's no separate, it's not a distraction. It's not a distraction. It's part of the story. It's part of how both he came to power and how he is abusing power. I mean, I think I'm one of those people that I do think that your everyday Trump voter is not going to give a shit about the Russia hacked the election story. I see that, you know, I see that they're not going to be moved by collusion arguments because in part, probably they do believe that the ends justify the means and Hillary was terrible and we should beat her any way we can. I do think that, I mean, maybe I'm being, I can't believe I'm going to use the word optimistic in the context of this conversation, but I'm going to. The kinds of vicious authoritarian policies that Trump and Sessions seem to be moving towards are going to hurt Trump voters too.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even just the direct effects, say, of healthcare policy that would take away the insurance or make it unaffordable for people in that block of voters. That's, you know, the so-called white working class.
Which it most definitely would. Yes.
Which it most definitely would. It's about the fact that systemic racism doesn't just hurt people of color. It hurts everyone. When you give police, say, the green light to be more brutal, to be more abusive, that has an effect on white people, too. I mean, it's not just the Justine Damon case in Minneapolis where this proves true, where, you know, you have jumpy, unqualified police officers with weapons who can create tragedy at a moment's notice. I'm talking about the fact that, you know, most people killed by police every year are white people. Mm-hmm. That's the heaviest demographic. Now, granted, proportionally by population in the United States, it's more black folks, you know, per capita, you know, within our population than white folks per capita. But the physical number of white people is the most. And so the idea that they shouldn't care about police violence, the idea that it's just an issue that black people should be concerned about is astounding. It's astounding logic. And so you have the president of the United States, you know, advocating more of this violence. That should have an effect on people. People should be able to recognize what systemic racism allows, what it permits, just as well as what it overtly does on its own.
Right. And it doesn't also ever really get to the part where it helps people in their everyday lives. Systemic racism, systemic violence is not going to make your life better.
Right.
Which is argument he seems to make all the time. Like, that's actually the underlying argument for the Trump presidency is I will be cruel to the brown and black people and you will get a job. But that doesn't, that's not...
It's the reason behind this immigration policy that he backed this week from the Senate, Tom Cotton and the other senator proposing this inhumane policy that would reduce immigration by 50%, I guess, over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Switching us to a skills-based system. Now, granted, Canada has a similar system, but it's not, you know, this is primarily directed at people who are coming in from non-English speaking countries who are most likely not able to afford formal education and, you know, are, you know, quote unquote, taking jobs away from Americans. Who do you think he's talking about? He's not talking about immigrants from Poland. He's not talking about immigrants from Switzerland, okay, or from Russia for that matter. he's talking about people who are brown, who are coming from down south, coming from Central America, and coming from Mexico. And this is a policy designed to inhibit immigration from those folks, not to mention the motherland, the continent, Africa, as well. So, I mean, this is it's social engineering. It's not, you know, it's not job creation. And people need to understand it for what it is. And I'm glad that at least you saw some journalists yesterday starting to call it out for what it is. And also, I think you're going to see some Democrats, hopefully, hopefully calling it out for exactly what it is. It's not something just a policy to be opposed to. It's a philosophy that's dangerous.
Right. And I actually want to call out, Jim Acosta got a lot of credit for having, you know, a real heated exchange with Stephen Miller over this. But April Ryan and Glenn Thrush also were great on this issue. And April Ryan especially pointing out that this is an attempt by the Trump administration to turn minorities against each other and scapegoat each other.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Two moves this week were purely about that. It's the affirmative action thing was designed to turn Black folks, Asian folks, and Latino folks against one another. The idea that Asians are now the sort of the Trojan horse into the elimination of affirmative action. You see now that there's a case at Harvard involving an Asian student who believes that there was discrimination involved in the rejection. And the same lawyer that helped Abigail Fisher lose her Supreme Court case is now backing this person. So that it's something I talked about with Sherilyn Eiffel, who's the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And she said, you know, it's such an obvious ham-handed strategy and it won't work, she said, because these groups are already working together to an extent that, you know, there's no chance that, the Trump administration with this kind of ridiculous policy is going to make any inroads towards further dividing our communities.
Right.
These communities are already working together in so many different ways to fight not only the Trump policies, but injustice everywhere. And there's just no chance that, you know, they're going to break people apart, but with, you know, this kind of silly nonsense. It's just red meat for the base, and it's red meat for, you know, for people who they want maybe the base to believe that these groups will turn against one another, or to believe that they should be opposed to one another. It's really not about actually turning us against one another, because they already know that probably that we're not really listening to them anymore.
Yeah, I actually think that it's a weird, I will give credit for, I guess, a multidimensional chess on this point, although I'm not sure how intentional it is, strategy, which is that they may overtly be looking like they're trying to turn minorities against each other, but the real target of their message is white people. They're not actually hoping that tactic will work. You know, I don't think that they really believe that tactic will work. I think they're just using it as a way of like telling white people that all see you're right. All of these people, they just fight amongst themselves and they're threats to you. But I don't know if they'll recognize how much this might backfire. I get to bring up, I think you know that this is one of my favorite recent statistics, statistical trends. There's so few of them that are good. I like to embrace this one, which is that the African-American community in America used to be kind of a lagging indicator on approving of same-sex marriage and same-sex rights or LGBTQ rights. Ever since we started having the argument about being able to refuse service to people of, LGBTQ community, African Americans have started to, you know, you could have seen it coming. I think I did. They've started to approve more of expanding the rights for gay and lesbian people. Thank you.
I mean, the idea
Thank you, Mike Pence, for making people realize.
I want to strike back at this myth. It's like the myth that like Black folks who go to church hate all gay people is something that's really pernicious. I think that if you reach out to Black churches nowadays, which go every week, if you reach out to Black churches nowadays and you see the acceptance, the wide berth of personalities and lifestyles that are within the Black church, I think that fiction would be really disproven pretty quickly. Unfortunately, you don't see too many, frankly, predominantly white press, predominantly white politicians in churches, unless there's a political event happening in that church. So,
but it's just not surprising at all to see that the Black community would see what's being done to same sex couples and think, hey, wait a minute, that looks awfully familiar to me. John Lewis, he's taken to, he posts the picture of him getting arrested for using the whites only bathroom and pointing to that in the continuity of the bathroom bills in places like North Carolina. Bathroom politics is not small beer,
Right. Yeah. And that actually gets me on another beef that I have right now. It's just that, you see John Lewis and some other Democrats highlighting the fact that these issues, trans people being able to use the bathroom of their choice, for instance, is an economic issue. It has real impact at home and so in your checkbook, whatever, however you want to term it. The recent Democratic plan, this is Better Deal, seems to ignore identity politics altogether in favor of this economic agenda that seems to kind of come out of the Bernie Sanders sort of class only thinking, which is let's cater to this, again, so-called white working class, these folks who maybe voted for Obama and now voted for Trump in the last election. And we're going to make sure that they are reached. We're going to make sure that we cater our platform to reach them. Well, what about the people who have been standing with you all along? A lot of whom were disenchanted the last election and didn't show up, or a lot of whom were disenfranchised. A lot of whom are bearing the majority of the attacks, both physical and political, from this administration. And so I'm really curious to know what the Democrats plan to do, especially given that now, you have the campaign head talking about, it's okay if someone in a, who's running as a Democrat doesn't believe in abortion rights. What? Really?
Well,
that's okay.
Wow. Just in time for us to wrap up, you've now introduced the topic that we really should devote a whole show to. which I'm serious. I think we should at some point, maybe we should have you back to talk about it, because I think that this Fair Deal, New Deal, Better Deal, 2-for-1 deal, buy one, get one free deal. Like, I don't know. I don't like the whole deal. I don't think politics should be thought of in terms of deals, deal to me is the kind of thing that I don't know if they consciously were trying to echo Trump personally, but that was his catchphrase during the campaign, right? I'm going to negotiate better deals. Right.
And they think they're echoing FDR, and what they are doing is just simply, it seems like they're biting off Trump. And it's not a good branding, but yes, I'd love to come back.
Well, we should definitely.
I'm writing about it at the moment.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely have you back. But we should wrap up now. I really appreciate you coming on. It was nice to chat and catch up with you, and thank you for sharing your experience with us. People can find you at the Daily Beast for now. What is your Twitter handle? I'm blanking at the moment.
Just at Jamil Smith,
@JamilSmith. All right. And they can follow you there too. You are everywhere.
Just trying to keep up with you, my friend.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show. And we'll chat Better Deal soon.
No doubt.
And that is it for our show today. If you want to catch up with our guests, Jamil just gave his Twitter handle, which is @JamilSmith. Brian Lyman can be found @Lyman_Brian, which is LYMAN_Brian. The show itself is @Crooked_Friends. I am actually taking off Twitter for the month of August. My tweeting will be handled by other people. You'll get your dose of adorables on Friday, but otherwise it'll be pretty quiet. I'm @AnnaMarieCox if you still want to follow. You can write the show if you have more than 140 characters worth of thoughts at withfriendslikepod@gmail.com. We are collecting both the experience of trans people and questions that you might have for our adults-only sex ed show, which we're putting together. And you know what? You have made it to the end of the episode. You have made it to the end of the week. Congratulations. Some of us had to fight harder than others to get here. And if you're like me, you may be drawn to be thinking about what you didn't do this week and what you should have done this week, what you meant to do this week, what you did wrong this week. You made it through the week. I made it through the week. I have to remind myself to be kind to myself sometimes. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to others. And we'll be back next week.
If there's anything better than getting a few of your favorite things from McDonald's, it's getting a few of your favorite things from McDonald's for less in the McDonald's app. Delicious. Order in the McDonald's app today. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Right now, only in the app. Enjoy a breakfast sandwich for just $1, like a sausage McMuffin with egg. Offer valid one time per day from 4/29 to 5/12/24 at participating McDonald's. Must opt into rewards.